Iowa is home to 67 different amphibian and reptile species, all deep in hibernation right now. This hour, we'll find out how to get up close and personal with these critters when they wake up. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Herpetologist Jeffrey LeClaire has just published a new field guide to the amphibians and reptiles of Iowa. We'll talk about the different species that make their homes here and what the future may hold for them. And the new documentary Wrestling with Iowa follows two young men as they attempt to become four-time state champions in wrestling. I'll talk with filmmaker Tim Jackson about the stories he tells and wrestling culture in Iowa. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Frogs, toads, salamanders, lizards, snakes, and turtles in Iowa are all in a deep sleep right now, but they appear in vibrant color on the pages of the new field guide to the amphibians and reptiles of Iowa, written by herpetologist Jeffrey LeClaire. He's also the man behind herpnet.net, a wonderful web resource for learning about and identifying these creatures. And Jeffrey's here with me now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Charity. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, there are 67 different species of amphibians and reptiles in Iowa. And of course, most of us, if we encounter any of them at all, probably only see three or four different species a year. How does Iowa compare to other places in the United States as far as species diversity goes?
Well, it's kind of right in the middle there. Obviously, as you go towards the south, the climate starts to warm, and of course, most amphibians and reptiles really like warm climates, and so places like Florida and even Missouri have, or Missouri, I guess I should say, have over 100 species of amphibians and reptiles. But if you go to my home state, which is up in Minnesota here, we knock back to about 50 or 51 species. So as you go north, your species diversity is lessened. And as you go south, your species diversity increases dramatically.
Now, before you included each species in this field guide, what did you have to do to verify that they actually are indeed living in Iowa?
Well, for the most part, that is a job of the state. So the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and the state of Iowa basically determine what species live or are native to Iowa. And basically what that means is that these animals have to have a successful reproducing viable population within the state of Iowa. And so all of the species that I chose to put in the book have demonstrated to have a sustainable reproducing population within the state. There are some species that are mentioned in the species of possible occurrence that live close to Iowa, but have either not actually been found in the state or have only been found in such small numbers, usually, you know, only one or two specimens, that we have not been able to determine that they have, you know, a reproducing population here.
Now, I have conversations with a wildlife biologist, Jim Pease, on a regular basis on this show, and we have found with so many species over the past couple of decades that there have been a lot of changes in Iowa. There are species that are making comebacks in the state. There are species that just seem to be spending more time further north. Do we see shifts with these species as well in recent decades?
Absolutely. And one of the, I guess, the poster herp species for that would be the cricket frog. The cricket frog was once very common in the state of Iowa. And northern populations in the mid-80s, late 80s or so, began to really rapidly decline. And as a matter of fact, in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, they almost became extirpated. And that happened in northern Iowa, too. But south of the kind of that I-80 line, most cricket frog populations were still doing very, very well. So into the 90s and into the early 2000s, we saw very few populations in the northern part of the state. But now, in the last few years, we've noticed that these populations have started to rebound. And so now we're even starting to see them in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota and in other places in northern Iowa where they used to be found but haven't been seen in about a decade or so.
There are just wonderful pictures in the book. Where did you find all the pictures, and did you take some of them yourself?
All of the pictures are taken by me.
Oh, okay.
And that was a project.
I'm sure it was. How long did that take you?
Oh, that took me many years. That took me roughly 8 to 10 years or so, I suppose. Maybe a little less than that. But it took many, many trips down to Iowa to locate and find some of these species. And as you can imagine, with some of the threatened and endangered species or just plain uncommon species, that was very difficult to do. And it took many trips sometimes to find a certain specimen or a certain specimen that looked typical. In other words, it was a good representative of the species, how they appear in the state of Iowa, and then get good photos of them that are good enough to put in a book. And so all of these factors combined sometimes created several trips down just for one species in the state. And basically, I was able to find every single species that occurs in Iowa except for two. That's the Great Plains skink and, of course, the northern crawfish frog, which hasn't been seen in Iowa since the 1940s.
You refer to people who spend a lot of time out looking for these different species as herpes. How long have you been a herpy?
Well, herper is actually
right.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Inappropriate.
Yeah, not a disease.
How long have you been a herper?
I've been a herper all of my life. Ever since I was a young kid, I have been just passionate about amphibians and reptiles. And I guess it started all with dinosaurs. I was into dinosaurs for a very short time. And then when I started reading about them, I was like, wow, you know, all of these dinosaurs are extinct. And, you know, while I thought they were, you know, neat animals, I wanted something that I could actually study. I wanted to have something like a Tyrannosaurus rex in my backyard. And when I realized that wasn't the case, a lot of the things that I was reading at the time, now, of course, this is not what they think nowadays, but at the time they thought that amphibians and reptiles were the closest living ancestors to the extinct dinosaurs. And so my focus quickly shifted over to amphibians and reptiles, and there it has remained ever since. And so I'm just, I'm a lifelong, I guess you could say I'm a lifelong herper. And the reason it's called herper is because amphibians and reptiles together, placed in one group, are called herpetofauna. And really, amphibians and reptiles are very different organisms from one another. They're not really related at all. But traditionally, they've been placed into kind of a single group. If you're a herpetologist, you study amphibians as well as reptiles. And so that's where the term, basically encompasses both of these two very different groups.
In the introduction to the book, you give quite a lot of advice for people who want to go out and see these different species. And clearly you are an expert at finding these. Let's start with frogs. If you want to see different species of frogs, I know you recommend starting with listening.
Right. And, you know, male frogs usually give an advertisement call. And this is done by different species at different times of the year, although most are done by about July or August. And they start anywhere from March on warm years into April. And so you can find males of these species by just going down to wetlands and listening for these advertisement calls. And a lot of times they're so different from one another that one can easily recognize one species from another. And so that's a really good way to find calling frogs. And as a matter of fact, it's so such an easy way to detect these species that there is something called the Iowa Frog and Toad Survey, and citizen scientists can go out and participate in this survey because it's such a, you know, an easy thing to do to help, keep an eye on these trends. And of course, the results are submitted to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, where they keep this data and they can look at trends over time. Another good way to look for amphibians and reptiles, or frogs in particular, is just to, outside of their breeding season, go down by the wetlands and just see what you can find hopping into the water.
Well, it is a little more exciting to actually see them. But you, with all of these photos, clearly you are more than seeing these creatures. You're able to take these really vibrant pictures. So let's say you want to take pictures of frogs. How do you get so close? How do you get these great shots?
Well, usually I have to capture them first because they don't allow you to approach closely enough. And at the time that I was, you know, photographing a lot of these animals, I didn't have a really big telephoto lens to go out and take photos from afar like you do with some species of frogs and basking turtles and such without disturbing them. So I had to go out. I had to hand capture all of the specimens that you see in the book are captured, and then you kind of just set them in a position and kind of make a lot of times if I didn't shoot them right in the field, right in their habitat, sometimes I would have to set up a habitat to create a composition in the background, and then just shot them that way. And it tries your patience quite a bit because a lot of times the animals do not want to cooperate with you. So, you know, you have to be very, very gentle with them. But if you're very patient with them, and a lot of times they will allow you to get good photographs of them. But
so
I
what's
did
your,
have to capture them.
What's your best secret for catching a frog without hurting it?
Oh, boy, I don't know if there's any secrets to catch. A lot of people use nets, but, you know, actually, one of the things that I like to do is kind of called like the bait and switch, where I'll creep up on a frog and get about as close as I can, just about within hand striking distance. And then I will use my other arm and my other hand to kind of, you know, I'll wiggle my fingers, and that will distract the frog. The frog will be looking at whatever's moving rather than me and my ever-approaching other hand to nab the frog. And that's really what works the best for me. And it takes a lot of practice.
So you don't use a net?
No, I don't like using nets usually because I don't like carrying nets around with me is the reason. But now for other people who want to go out and try to capture frogs, nets are great. I mean, you have a much higher success rate with less practice using a net to capture frogs. But typically, I don't like to use nets.
We're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking this hour with Jeffrey LeClair. He has just published a new field guide to the amphibians and reptiles of Iowa. We'll get some more advice for getting out in the field and getting up close and personal with these critters in just a moment. We'll also talk about the place that they hold in our ecosystem and what the future holds for many of these different species as well. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100 with your questions. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Now maybe you won't see him, maybe you won't hear, but he'll sneak up behind you and drink all of your root beer. And then sneaky snake goes dancing, wiggling and a-hissing. Sneaky snake goes dancing, giggling and a-kissing. I don't like old sneaky snake, he laughs too much, you see. When he goes wiggling through the grass, it tickles his underneath.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to shift subjects and talk about a new documentary called Wrestling with Iowa, which follows two young men as they seek to become four-time state champions in wrestling in the state of Iowa. But right now, we are talking about amphibians and reptiles. A new field guide to the amphibians and reptiles of Iowa has just been published by Jeffrey LeClair, and he is with me now. And before the break, we were talking about some of the ways that you get up close to frogs out in the wild. You also write a lot about some of the special care that you take when you capture a salamander. And in many, I mean, you really recommend that if you really don't need to handle a salamander, don't do it.
That's right. Yeah. And that's true for pretty much all amphibians and reptiles, but frogs and salamanders, amphibians, in particular because of their semi-permeable skin.
Well, and where do you find salamanders? They are tough to find.
Salamanders are tough to find because most of the salamanders that we have in Iowa are part of a group called the mole salamanders. And mole salamanders, of course, get their name because they spend most of their time underground. If they're not underground, then they're in a wetland somewhere breeding, usually very, very early in the spring before the ice is even off the ponds. They're in the wetlands breeding, and you don't get a chance to see them. So it's very, very difficult to find salamanders. And in the way that usually people are familiar with tiger salamanders, but that's because the salamanders essentially come to the people because when it rains and there's a heavy thunderstorm, at least this was the way it was 10 or 20 years ago, a lot of these salamanders would come up out of from underground, and you'd see them crossing roads, you'd see them in basements and cisterns, in window wells and things like that. So most of the time that people see salamanders, it's because the salamanders come to them rather than people going out and finding them.
So it's not so much a where, it's a when.
Yeah, most of the time, for your average Iowans, for people who want to actually try to find salamanders, going out into woodland habitats and looking under things like moist logs and decaying logs is the best way to find salamanders. The problem with that, though, is that you want to be careful about which logs you look under and how you do it, because you don't want to rip the log apart. That's the home for that salamander and whatever else is living under there. So you have to be very careful when you go into their habitat and try to find them.
Well, speaking of careful, when you write about looking for turtles, it doesn't sound like you're very careful. I mean, you write about careful ways to handle turtles, and of course that's extraordinarily important with, say, a snapping turtle. But you write about going noodling or muddling to look for turtles. Describe what that is for us.
Noodling or muddling is when you get into the water. This is for aquatic species. Now, you get into the water and you feel around in the mud. And when you hit, you know, when you feel something that sounds like a, you know, that, you know, feels like a turtle, you grab it. You have to be careful.
I was going to say, that doesn't really sound that safe.
It's not. It's actually more safer for them than it is for the person who's doing it. But, you know, one of the interesting things about turtles and snappers in particular and other species of turtles is that they're a lot more docile under the water than when you take them up out of the water. For instance, you can get away with a lot more with a snapping turtle while it's under the water than you can once you lift it out of the water and you bring it onto the land. Then it turns into the aggressive beast that I think most people are familiar with. But really, I mean, I've come up on the mouth end of a snapping turtle, you know, while muddling before, and have not been bit. As a matter of fact, I've never been bit underwater by a snapping turtle before.
But so. You have been bit above.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I have. As a matter of fact, as far as snapping turtles go, I have only been bit really one time by a snapping turtle, and that was my own fault. And as what happened there is that there was a person who had a lot of snapping turtles in one stock tank, and I was kind of looking through to see the more interesting snapping turtles that I might be able to pick out of there. And I reached in there to grab one of the snapping turtles, you know, by its shell. And I wasn't paying attention to how close there another snapping turtle was, and it bit me on the hand. But one-on-one with a snapping turtle on the land, I've never been bit.
So when you find a turtle under the mud, you can't see it underwater in most of our ponds and places where you'd be looking are not very clear. So especially if you've gotten everything all stirred up, do you identify turtles just by how they feel? Like species?
Yes, snapping turtles have a very rough shell. They have a very pronounced keel down the back of their shell, and if you look at the rear edge of their shell, it's heavily serrated. So that means it has those kind of those teeth at the back, and so when you're feeling around the shell, you can feel those at the back, and that's unique to most of the turtle species that we have in Iowa. If it's a smaller, more kind of round shell, then I know that it's something like perhaps a map turtle or a painted turtle or something like that. So they can really give you a really good clue. And of course, if you feel something that is like a pancake, you know you have one of the soft shell species. So those different types of shells can help you at least differentiate between groups of turtles,
maybe not to species level. The soft shell species, you just have some really amazing, I mean, all the pictures in here are really remarkable, but the soft shell turtles are such interesting looking creatures and so much fun to see the pictures of them. I'll be honest, though, I didn't realize that we had native species of lizards. How many different kinds of lizards do we have in Iowa?
We have five species of lizards, and to be quite frank with you, a lot of times they just they don't get a lot of attention. There haven't been a lot of studies done on lizards in Iowa, but we do have some very diverse species. One of them, as a matter of fact, is a threatened species. So we have. A couple of species, three species of skinks. We have the five-line skink, the northern prairie skink, and then, of course, the endangered Great Plains skink. And then we have one species of race runner, which is a teid lizard, which looks like a skink, but it has a lot of different scalation. The scales are very different on the body. And then, of course, the very interesting-looking slender glass lizard, which... to most people, if they saw it in the wild, they would think it's a snake, and that is the threatened species that we have in the state. So a lot of these species, deserve our attention. And the glass lizard, I think, of all of them has received the most attention, but I think more can be done.
Looking at the different, in all of the different species, you, of course, have their range, a map of where they're found and where they live. And it seems that the obviously with two that are threatened, they're not ranging very far, but they all seem to have much more limited ranges than some of the other creatures that you write about.
Yeah, absolutely. The glass lizards are found in a very they're found in tall grass prairie, and there's not a lot of that left. As a matter of fact, it's a very endangered ecosystem in Iowa. And of course, the Great Plains skink coming in from the southwest, that's more of a, obviously a Great Plains species. And so they're very common in places like Kansas and other states like that. But when you get into Iowa, they're only found in a couple of counties down there, right along the Luss Hills. Now, a lot of people haven't spent a lot of time looking for new populations for Great Plains skinks, so there might be more there than what we think. But, they have very reduced ranges. The other species are a little bit more widespread, and I just think that they're underreported as far as, like, the northern prairie skinks and the race runners.
Let's talk a little bit about snakes. And, of course, with all of the animals that you write about in the amphibians and reptiles of Iowa, snakes are the ones that probably have the worst reputation. People still really feel nervous about snakes. How many different species of snake do we have in Iowa?
27 species, and I think that shocks a lot of people, because of all the amphibian and reptile groups that we have in the state of Iowa, the highest number of species in any of those groups is snakes, at nearly 30 species, so 27 species.
And again, as someone who lives in Iowa and spends a lot of time in rural Iowa, I've probably only seen maybe four or five of these different species of snakes. Is this a... we don't tend to encounter them that much.
Well, yeah, and, again, it kind of speaks to the partitioning of habitats that we have within Iowa. The species that people are most familiar with are usually things like garter snakes, because they adapt very well to disturbed habitats. And so they can survive in areas that have dealt with things like development and agriculture and those types of situations. But unfortunately, most of the other herp species in Iowa don't fare as well with these types of habitat alterations. So you have all these other snakes snake species that have very limited ranges. And then the second species that probably a lot of Iowans are familiar with are bull snakes. And really what they're probably seeing are western fox snakes rather than bull snakes. Bull snakes used to be very common in Iowa when most of the state was tall grass, flat prairie. Unfortunately, that is the first habitat, the easiest habitat to switch to agriculture land or develop or, you know, something like that. But fox snakes live in more wooded along river corridors, areas with these buffers, small buffers of habitats that usually persist. And so the fox snake has now become the most common snake species seen, except for garter snakes and perhaps brown snakes. So a lot of times people think they're seeing bull snakes, but they're really seeing fox snakes. Bull snakes have suffered a dramatic decline.
Now, of course, the thing that everybody wants to know about snakes is, do we have poisonous snakes in Iowa?
We have four species of venomous snakes. We have the timber rattlesnake, we have the eastern Massasauga, we have the copperhead, and we have the prairie rattlesnake. And all of those species are endangered in Iowa except the timber rattlesnake. And so for most Iowans, it's very, very unlikely that you'll see any of those. Even the timber rattlesnake, you have to go into a specific habitat to be able to find those snakes.
With amphibians like frogs and salamanders, you mentioned their permeable skin. They are species that seem to be very affected by pollution. And of course, all of these species are very affected by loss of habitat. How would you characterize the health of these species in Iowa today?
Well, I think that overall, we believe that most of them are declining. Just because of the loss of habitat and because of all the pollutants and water quality and basically just the overall health of the ecosystem. Some animals are stable. Some species are stable, and I think that those are the ones, again, that I said that are very adaptable to a lot of these disturbances, things like, chorus frogs, American toads, garter snakes, both species of garter snakes that we have, plains and eastern garter snakes, they can withstand that. And so I think a lot of people see those. But we have to keep in mind that the majority of amphibians and reptiles rely on a specific type of environment, a specific habitat, and they just can't adjust to other types of habitats. And so when alteration of habitats or pollution occur, they can't cope with it. And so, again, like you mentioned before, most Iowans don't see these other species of herps in the first place just because of the different places that they live. But because they can't adapt to other areas, they're severely affected by these types of changes in our environment. And because these changes keep occurring, at an alarming rate, I think that we believe that they're on a downward trend.
And a lot of people consider these species to be sort of the canary in the coal mine, that these species are being affected by changes to climate, changes to habitat and pollution at higher rates than other species. But they believe that that means it's coming for other species as well. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true. And I think, again, that amphibians are kind of the forefront of that way of thinking because they have semi-permeable skin, and because they do not have direct development. They lay their eggs in aquatic habitats for the most part. They lay their eggs in aquatic habitats, and so they're directly affected by water quality. And so we can it's sort of a fast forward to seeing these malformations with amphibians. It's sort of fast forward to what could happen to humans if we allow these changes to persist and continue. So I definitely think that they are, the canaries in the coal mine for humans. And again, people, we don't see these changes happening right now. Well, in some cases we do, but not as quickly as they do in the amphibians. And that's one thing that we have to keep in mind, that they are a good representative for what may happen to humans down the road because of their semi-permeable skin and because of the way that they develop from egg in the water to larva in the water to transformation into a semi-aquatic or semi-terrestrial adult.
You make a very strong case for why all of us should care about conservation of these species. What can we do? How can I make a difference?
Well, the best thing to do, if I was to give one, recommendation, would be to help the habitat that we have in Iowa. And there are many different places to do that, and many different methods to do that. But I think the number one thing is honestly with donations. If you want to make, the biggest impact, help places in Iowa that help, either restore habitats or, ideally preserve habitats within the state. And so there's places like the Wildlife Diversity Program, the NRCS, the Nature Conservancy, County Conservation Board. I think a lot of people can really help out by, when they file their taxes, to donate to the Chickadee Checkoff, which is, if you look on your tax form, that will be the Fish and Wildlife Fund. Give to the Fish and Wildlife Fund, because these are the organizations that can really help protect habitat for these animals. They can acquire habitat, they can restore habitat, and they can also preserve habitat.
You also write that a well-groomed park with a pond does nothing for most of these species. Is that something else that we can do if we have a farm pond, if we have access to a park, try to leave some habitat around the edge?
Absolutely. If you have a farm pond, or you have a piece of land that can be restored or enhanced or managed, then I would definitely contact either the Wildlife Diversity Program or the NRCS. Both of those programs like to work with landowners to be able to enhance the habitat that they have.
And we are out of time, Jeff, but thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Jeffrey LeClaire is the author of the new Field Guide to Amphibians and Reptiles in Iowa. You can also see his work at herpnet.net.
In her room, and I found out that it was my loving spouse. Oh, the snakes call at night. That's what they say.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The new documentary, Wrestling with Iowa, begins with these words. In the 87 years of high school wrestling in the state of Iowa, 1,648 young men have won 2,150 state championship titles. Only 21 have won all 4 years in a row. The documentary follows two young men as they attempt to join that elite group of athletes and become four-time state wrestling champions. At the start of the film, we meet the first four-time state champion in the years 1959 to 1962. His name is Bob Steenlage.
So he has his shake hands. By this time, my arm is tightening up. And he... he grabs my arm, puts it up in the air, and I remember it was just like a shot of pain, down to my foot. He said, "Son, I'd like to congratulate you because you've just won the state championship for the fourth time." And they're making this announcement. For the first time ever in the state of Iowa, somebody's won the state championship. And for the fourth time, everybody started clapping, stood up. And then I looked at my mom and grandmother up in the crowd, and it was worth every bit of sacrifice. And that moment has affected the rest of my life.
That is a moment from the new documentary, Wrestling with Iowa. And filmmaker Tim Jackson is here. He's the man behind the documentary. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, when you set out to make a documentary about Iowa wrestling, this was not the film that you had in mind. What was your original plan?
The original plan was a photography book. I was a still photographer for a long time, shot a lot of sports, and started off as a photography book, and it didn't really go anywhere back in 2005. and kind of got stuck back in my book of ideas, and decided to go to film school at Ohio University about 3.5 years ago. And when it came time to come up with a thesis idea, went back in my book, and sure enough, it was there, number 4, Wrestling with Iowa. And, you know, went back and kind of looked at some of the records and saw what was going on, and just happened to be a perfect opportunity to follow two boys as they went for their 4th last season.
And you, you're based in Athens, Ohio. Do you have history in Iowa?
I lived in Keokuk for a very brief time when I was a kid, and then ended up living in central Illinois for the duration of high school and through college.
So what is it about wrestling culture in Iowa that, I mean, you spent a lot of years trying to get a project going on wrestling in Iowa. What is it about this culture that made it so compelling to you?
Well, the original concept was, you know, boiled down, it was kind of like a sport in a state. Iowa and wrestling, Indiana and basketball, Minnesota and hockey, Texas and football, that round. And I was just, you know, it started off being more like why the farm culture led into such great wrestlers. And that may have been the case 20 or 30 years ago, but it's the history. It's, you know, there's a very rich history of wrestling in the state. And it's, you know, I just found it amazing.
Well, as you said, you came and started looking at this subject at just the right time to follow two young men who had the opportunity possibly to be 4-time state champions, Brandon Sorensen from Denver, from the Denver Tripola School District, and Jake Marlin from Creston. They had just become 3-time state champions, and you followed them through the next season to see what happened. You also went back and talked to a number of these 21 4-time champions. As you went back and you talked to these men who had achieved this goal, what did they say about it? What was a thread that you found in all of these different interviews?
Well, we were able to go back and actually talk with all of them, tracked every single one of them down, and they were very gracious with their time and the interviews and such. What I found in after wrestling was that each of them had found their own level of success and their own definition of happiness. They were all very content and successful in their own rights, and they all went different paths. And it all boils back down to, with the wrestling, with the work ethic involved in wrestling. And a lot of the guys were saying, you know, the high school wrestling was the toughest thing they did in their life. And then, you know, that kind of defined how they approach the rest of their, you know, adulthood.
In getting to know these two young men, I was really struck that both of them started wrestling when they were about 3 years old.
Yeah, that's part of the culture, is that, you know, families got them into wrestling, you know, pretty much at that age. You know, you give them a singlet and headgear and shoes and point them towards the mat and say, you know, go have some fun. And I had a chance to sit down or attend some youth wrestling tournaments. And the kids, you know, they know the 3 basic moves or 4 basic moves, and they go out there and they have fun, and they're not sure exactly what happens or how everything's scored. But, you know, that's kind of where it all starts.
So in elite wrestling in Iowa, is there a sense that all of these young men who achieve this level of skill started when they were that young?
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with summer wrestling. It's not just a seasonal sport for these guys. It's a year-round activity. And just the level of dedication, you know, you get into it early. It's not like, some high school sports where a kid gets to, you know, freshman in high school and says, oh, I want to, you know, join this team or that team. A lot of people do that. But the ones that are working at the elite level have, you know, they've got 10 years under their belt before they get to high school.
Well, I found it interesting. I think it was Brandon's family in Denver, Iowa. You also interviewed his parents and other people in his life for both of the young men. And his parents were talking about how he started so early. And his dad kept saying things like, well, you know, his big brother was doing it, so he wanted to do it, and kind of making it sound like it was all Brandon's idea. And then his mom interrupts and said, well, I do remember that one time when he was five and he told you that he was going to play basketball and you yelled at him. So, was there a lot of family pressure on these boys?
No, I don't think it was family pressure. I think it's just, part of what they do. It's kind of like I kind of came up with a phrase while I was driving back and forth across Iowa, define your own normal. And in both families, they've got wrestling rooms, they've got brothers or sisters or family members or friends that would come over, and that's the activity that they chose. And so there was never a shortage in Brandon's place. There was never a shortage of people to spar against. And in Creston, kind of the same thing.
Well, and did you also find that – I know that they also participated in other sports. Brandon was in cross country as well, and his coach said he gives 100% no matter what he does. But to be the kind of wrestlers that they are, do they have to pretty much focus on wrestling year-round?
Yeah, for the most part. It's still high schoolers, and it's not the Olympic level quite yet. But Brandon chose to use cross country as kind of a – warm up and to stay in shape, and he'd done that for the last 4 years, so that was part of his conditioning and regimen. And I'll tell you, after doing cross country practice, he'd go back to his house and lift weights for half an hour, and then find somebody to wrestle. And then Jake had played football earlier, but had kind of moved on to just focusing on wrestling, and he was a part of a couple clubs down in Creston, and would travel with his family to go work out with his friends.
Now, for people who follow wrestling closely in Iowa, they already know the end of this story. For people who don't, you want to save that for people who watch the film. But who do you imagine is the audience for this story?
Well, originally, you look at a film like this and you go, oh, it could be a sports doc. That's the easy route. And what I didn't want to do was make it all about wrestling, how it gets scored and the moves and everything like that, and just like endless wrestling. Had no desire to do something like that. I really wanted to get in and find out who these two boys were and what kind of made them tick, and the families and the whole culture and the whole community of wrestling.
So in getting to know these young men, what surprised you?
The level of dedication. And it's not just, oh, I go practice for 2 hours a day. It's, the nutrition and keeping weight and making weight. And then, both the boys are pretty much into two-a-day workouts during school year. So they wake up and go and do a 6:30 workout and then do school and then do another, team practice afterwards.
Do they have time to just be kids?
Yeah, they find time. That's kind of like off season. That's what off season's for.
Although it sounds like there is no off season.
They roll right from one thing to the next. And that's how they get to the level that they're at.
In talking to each one of them, what did they say about what it meant to be three-time state champions? What does that achievement mean?
Well, I think for people that can work and compete at that level, there's a real wrestlers are really humble, and some of them don't like to talk about their victories, and they just don't dwell on it. They just kind of go to work, and that's one of the things that was kind of amazed me, that there wasn't a lot of celebration during the school year, during the regular season. It was just like, you get your hand raised, you walk off the mat, and you look for the next one.
Both of their coaches talked about all of their victories in the past, and each of them had different kinds of careers in their elementary school years. But did you visit their bedrooms? I mean, did you see all of these awards? Because they must each have had just hundreds of ribbons and plaques and trophies from all of these tournaments that they'd participated in for so long.
And the walls are covered with brackets. I was able, I actually filmed both the rooms, and it didn't make the final cut. But both of them had, you know, they're high schoolers, they're teenagers, and you know, it's like, okay, I'm gonna put one trophy up in my room, and then of course they get more and more and more, and little plaques and stuff like that. So both rooms were, Brandon's room was filled wall to wall with brackets from previous tournaments, from important tournaments, and plaques and trophies, and they get some pretty impressive trophies traveling around the country doing the wrestling stuff. And then Jake had his medals hanging on a pull-up bar in the door, and there, you know, you kind of have to walk past him every time you go in and out of his room. But, you know, you look at it, it's just an amazing collection of accomplishments, basically.
Now, of course, in wrestling, the weight that the competitor is extremely important in deciding who they will wrestle, and this is something that a lot of these young men spend a lot of time managing. And it's something that a lot of people have concern about, the body image of these young men and things they may be doing to damage themselves in an effort to drop weight quickly, that kind of thing. Did you talk to them about that?
A little bit, but it's part of the culture and the sacrifice that they do to work at elite level of wrestling. Brandon, in fact, had wrestled at 125, and he jumped up to 145. And there was some change in there with the weight classes, but he had actually jumped up, so he didn't have to cut so much this last year. And, you know, it was just, there was the coaches and the parents all said there was a positive change in personality with him when he wasn't cutting so much. It's all very controlled and regulated. They do a lot of body fat testing, the state association's really good about making sure that they don't get into unhealthy habits that are extremely damaging.
Now, with all of the focus that both of these young men and so many others in the state of Iowa put on wrestling in their high school years, what about the future? Did you talk to them about what the future looked like past wrestling?
Yeah, well, both of them are with the University of Iowa now in wrestling. They're both redshirting this year. So they've got a college career ahead of them, another 4.5 years at this point. And then beyond that, Jake was always pretty vocal about wanting to compete in the Olympics, which was in jeopardy over this last summer. You know, just the way wrestling and maturity works, he would have been a prime example of being an athlete at the 2020 Olympics. And with the International Olympic Committee cutting Olympics or trying to cut Olympics, that became a concern. But it wasn't until after the state finals. That was all this last summer.
So they're not ready to look past wrestling yet.
No. Both of them are heavily into wrestling. And, you know, they may end up being coaches. I know Brandon has aspirations into business. You know, it's all up in the air. And you know, with the skills that they learn through wrestling, it really is wide open, and they'll find their own level of success and their own happiness.
Now, all this week, the movie has been premiering at small town theaters across the state of Iowa. It's going to show at the Camelot Theater in Nevada tonight at 7 p.m. and the Daly Community Auditorium in Oskaloosa tomorrow night at 7. Have you been to all of these showings?
Yes, I am personally driving around to all of these, and that's kind of half the fun of making a movie. You know, this whole movie was a thesis project for my master's degree at Ohio University, and to be able to finish up the project and go, wow, I actually have a movie that I can show in movie theaters. I'm happy. It's amazing.
Well, and what are you learning about wrestling culture in Iowa from this experience?
You know what? It's when I came back into Iowa, it's like, wow, I'm back home, because I spent so much time with both the families and with the community of wrestling. And it's kind of like, wow, I'm just really comfortable coming back to Iowa and showing this movie. And, I'm just, you know, I'm happy. And the people that I meet are really super nice. And, I couldn't have picked a better project.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
The documentary is Wrestling with Iowa. I've been talking to filmmaker Tim Jackson, who's based in Athens, Ohio. You can find out more about the film at wrestlingwithiowa.com. And it is showing tonight, as I mentioned before, at the Camelot Theater in Nevada at 7 p.m. and then tomorrow night in the Daly Community Auditorium in Oskaloosa, premiering all this week in small towns across the state of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today from Cooper Hollemeyer. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to
Hi,
River.
Charity.
What's
Hi.
Coming up at noon today?
Well, you know, the meat industry is is always known for its controversy. Think pink slime or the Postville raid of 2008. Today, though, we're going to get a historical view of that from Maureen Ogle. She's a historian. Her new book is titled In Meat We Trust. And we find out about our meat history from the colonial period right up to the present, Charity, and we hope we'll have people join in our conversation.
Sounds fascinating. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to think about spring. We're going to talk with seed savers
new seed
catalog.
You think we dare?
Oh, I think we better.
<All right. laughs>
I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.